My name is Priscilla Allison. I'm recording this tape as part of an oral history project at the Dr. Alice Drought Gerontological Resource Center at the Area Agency on Aging, Region 1 in Phoenix, Arizona. The date of the recording is Monday, March 21st, 2005. The individual speaking is Joseph C. Holzer, who was born on August 29th, 1919, and was 86 years old at the time of this recording.
Okay.
All right.
Well, my name is Joseph Holzer, H-O-L-Z-E-R. I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana, 1919, so I'm now 67 years old and living in Phoenix, Arizona. Today is March the 21st, 2005. I'm going to be speaking about my military experiences during World War II. I was drafted in the Army in 1942. I was 22 years old at that time and living in Indianapolis, Indiana. My basic training was Signal Corps training at Camp Crowder, Missouri. My first assignment was to be moved to Camp Shanks for being sent overseas. And I was there sent to New York, where we deployed from one of the harbors there.
Mm-hmm. And when you went from New York, where did you go?
We went to Shrivenham, England, or to an English coast close to Shrivenham.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sent to a place called Oulton Park, which is about 40 miles out of London. Mm-hmm. And there we were in a tent city type of thing. And we stayed there for some months, three or four months, I believe. And it was a place where you could look out and see the green, just the land is just green as can be.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little stream behind us. And that's the only way you could keep clean, was jumping to that stream. And that's what we did, and I had appropriated a litter from a German litter that had got there somehow, and I made a bed in this tent out of the litter. And of course, it kept me out of the mud, because the streets were all nothing but mud there. So one day I was lying in that bed. We had nothing to do there but pass time, and a weapons carrier stopped out in front, and somebody called my name. So I went out to see, and they said, "Get your gear together, you're going with us." So that I did, and we got in there, and they collected about six other people from that same area, and we then went to what had been a English officers club or some kind of a organization like that, and we studied Morse code there. For months we were there. And then we went from there to cross the English Channel in a boat, an African boat, and arrived at the place where many of our soldiers died, the Omaha Beach. And that was some 6 weeks after that those poor fellas went up that beach, and as we topped it out, you could see many, many white crosses and neatly laid out there where they'd buried those folks.
Mm-hmm.
So we proceeded from there to go maybe we better stop it.
See what happens.
So the weapons carrier finally took us into farther away from this camp that we'd been into, and we came into the city of Paris, and see buildings popping up around on both sides of the highways. And we finally stopped in downtown Paris, quite close to the opera building. And the military person in charge says, get out, this is where you're going to live. So they took us to a hotel there. And we had nice clean rooms, hot water, cold water, and sheets, and maid service. And so then I was assigned to the Supreme Headquarters outfit, which they did correspondence broadcasting from our studios. We had three studios, audio studios, to broadcast back to the United States. And my job was mostly in recording, doing recordings for remotes and also anything that needed to be done around the studio, including there was a theater down the street where we would take transmit or wire equipment to broadcast back to our studio of Glenn Miller's orchestra. He was over there at the time, and we must have had 12, 13 sessions for them. And some officer got, when we left, got a pile of original Glenn Miller records somewhere, which we never saw, you know. But anyway, that was one thing that we did. I did the recordings at the studio from the theater. And also, we had, we must have had 12 correspondents that were there from the major networks, NBC, CBS, and Blue Network at that time. And there were some, Charles Collingwood was one. I don't know if you remember him, but he was quite a nice fellow. And quite a number of the main people from those broadcast companies, you know. And I did recordings of them, and I had charge of keeping 14 wire recorders operating for these fellows that would take on recording junkets of their own, you know. And that kept me busy pretty much. And after one day then, we found out that the president had died. And shortly after that, it was I think two or three weeks after that, or maybe a little longer, I got the colonel in charge of our group came in, and he said, I want you to pack this equipment, this dish recording equipment. It's a big old electric voice recorder. And he said, we're going to go on a little ride. And so I did. He says, there's a weapon carrier out front, put this in the back end, and you get in the front with me. And we took off and drove through. I didn't know where we were going, but we were going to Reims, France, for the surrender. And we got up there, and it was kind of like one of these situations, hurry up and wait. You know, we had to hurry up and get our recording equipment set up. And they had a beautiful walnut table in there, about twice as wide as this, and about 20 foot long, and they would only let us have one microphone. So, and that table must have cost, in those days, I don't know, thousands of dollars, because it was all ornate. Had to drill a hole right down through the middle of it to place this little microphone, which you can see on those pictures in there. And they didn't want the cord to be shown, so it went underneath back to my recorder. And so we got that all set up. I and some other, there were a couple of other fellows here that were with me on that. They weren't with me, but they were in our group, and they came up with someone else. I don't know who. I never did know who, but they helped get this ready. And this got this table all set up for these people. And see, there's the microphone, see? That was a rascal. And these little white things are ashtrays, and they had officers in there with string lining those all up perfectly, you know, so to make a show. But anyway, they said, well, we're going to have to wait. And he said that the people that we are going to have here aren't here yet. So they said, you can go get some sleep. And we've been up, I don't know how many hours. So we went off to a room. I lay down on the floor and got to sleep. And pretty soon somebody was shaking me. And they said, come on, we got to go. And so went back to this war room. And there all these people were brought in. And then that's when that happened. And General Eisenhower wasn't in there at that time because I guess military-wise, it's beneath the commanding general, the whole thing, to meet the defeated. I don't know why that was, but anyway, then they were, after this was all signed, they met in another room back there. I wasn't in on that, but then we got some sleep, and the next day I got a wild ride back to Paris in a Jeep with a guy, myself and one other guy. And that was the end of the surrender thing. But they had, by then, I was so tired, I went to bed. And when I first went to bed, I could hear people out in the streets celebrating VE Day, you know. But I never got to see it. Mm-hmm. It was the end of that for me. So. Yeah. He's German General Staff behind von Friedeberg. This was our man, Strong, and this is von Friedeberg. He was, what did he do? He was head of the German Navy. And this is Jodl. He's the one that signed all of the surrender documents. And this fellow's name is Oxnard. He was aide to this man here. Mm-hmm. And we had Walter Beadle Smith, he was over here, who was with the United States. He had control of this signing situation there. And that's about some of the stuff. This is the Russian, I think, representative at the end of the table there.
Was there a lot of conversation?
Not too much. This General Jodl made a speech, something like, with these documents, I commend the German nation into the hands of the victor and hope that we will be treated with, you know, good care and so forth. But that's about all he said, and there wasn't much else said, and they signed these. Hit the whole thing didn't take 20 minutes, so.
And how was the atmosphere in the room?
Well, all these people back here are correspondents, and they, about at the end of that, they were just going crazy to get their stories out, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, we were relieved because this was all over and we could go get some sleep. Mm-hmm. This gentleman was from our group, and this was my Colonel Walter Brown. He ran this whole PRD division, which we were in. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you make copies of the tapes as to what was said, or were a lot of pictures taken so that the correspondence?
Yeah, there were a lot of pictures. Here's a photographer here, mm-hmm. and there were many more, there were half a dozen more back over here on this side of the room. And we were just military people. We never got copies of that or anything. We, you know, just were there doing our job, so to speak. And so it was war. The maps of the war areas and how the advancement was going, and that was all pictured on that map. And brightly lighted, the whole thing was. And I understood that they changed some of the things on this map to give these German people a false indication of how far ahead they were. So I don't know. But that's what I heard. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So that was quite an important event to be part of that.
Well, it's history, you know. It's something mm-hmm. I couldn't conceive that I would ever be in that situation. But mm-hmm. The whole military is the luck of the draw, I believe, you know.
So what happened after the surrendering? Where were you assigned next?
Let's see, after the surrender our group was picked to go to the Nuremberg trials. Mm-hmm. We had to go there and install the system that allowed everyone in the courtroom to understand the language they understood. And each position was fitted with a pair of headphones and a switch, and you could switch to any language you understood or a verbatim one. And that's how everyone in the courtroom knew what was going on. And everything that we recorded from our microphones was sent to interpreters, which was at the back of the room, and they interpreted what was going down all these lines.
Was there much of a delay for the interpreting time?
No, but it did slow down the proceedings a little. They had to be sure that each one of the lines had finished with what had been said, you know, mm-hmm. interpreting. They were very, very fine interpreters. I thought an awful lot of them because that was a hairy job, I thought.
Sure was. How long did the trials go on?
They went on for about 11 months.
Mm-hmm.
I have some information that tells you the whole story of the trials. There were, you know, when you think of the Nuremberg trials, you think of this main one in Nuremberg, but there were like 8 or 9 other Nuremberg, so-called Nuremberg trials that were held there, but they were not this one with all of the German people there that were sentenced, you know. They were about judges that had done things that they shouldn't have, interpreted laws in favor of the Germans, and one thing and another. There were about 8 different groups of them, or maybe more, I'm not sure about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all, they had separate trials for all those people, and that whole group of trials lasted 4 or 5 years. I'm not sure about that either. I have that information at home, but not
mm-hmm.
here.
It's mm-hmm. yeah. a long time. And what was the atmosphere like in the courtroom in terms of how were people received and that kind of thing?
Well, the prisoners, there's pictures of them in there, were the thing that interested me most. They were still haughty and proud, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What was funny to me was that I got to see Göring, who was Reich Marshal of the Air Force, eat out of a mess kit, you know, and that must have really devastated him, because when he took his own life, that was at the trials, he took his own life, he had somehow gotten hold of a poison pill that did him in just a matter of a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
If he was kept in a little cell, you wouldn't believe that he could get anything in there, but he did. And from what we heard, he got this cyanide pill from an American lieutenant who had become friends with him. And Göring gave this gentleman his wristwatch. And I guess in return, that's what he did for him. I don't know. Because Göring considered that to be way beneath his position to be hung. He said he didn't mind being shot, but he didn't want to be hung, and he would not allow his captors to do that to him. So.
Do you remember any other people who stood out?
Rudolf Hess. Okay. Rudolf Hess flew out of Germany in 1941 or 2, I think, over to England, and there he was captured. But he went over there to try and get the English to make peace with the Germans. And he had a chronic stomach problem, and he would sit in that dock and he just wiggling on it, you know, he'd groan and carry on. And it was always fun to watch. not to watch his suffering, but just his antics that he did. And other than that, those were the two that interested in BMO. So there were 21 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them died before they could get him there, and I don't know what happened. I think there were a couple of more. One escaped, and finally they found that he had died, too, in another country, and I don't remember where that was. But 21 of these people, and all but, I think, three of them met their end in the galleys. Well, four, when you include Goring. And the army sent over a hangman to set up these gallows, and that was done down in a basement place. But you could, well, I guess he must have been using sandbags for testing that thing. You could hear that thing thump when he was doing it, you know. And they hung all of those people in about 2 hours. They had them in a the back end of the courtroom was a great big rotunda of buildings, which was the prison back in there. That's what they made the prison. And they said that Nuremberg, being the sort of the capital for Hitler's parades and so forth, you know, and the fact that there were not many cities left in Europe that could handle this, and the one of the main hotels was missed by the bomber, and also this Palace of Justice, so-called. And they said that Nuremberg had been devastated to 80% of the city, and you go out there and just look nothing taller than yourself, you know, and just piles of rubble. We went down one street one time in a Jeep, and the buildings were just all caved in around us, and all of us were heard a rumbling and a bunch of dust, and a building caved in right behind us.
Oh, it doesn't sound as if you want to spend much time outside.
No. not at that time we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But we were put up in about 5 miles from Nuremberg in a little town called Furth. And Eberhard Faber, the pencil man, had a castle there. And the army took that castle over, and that's where we lived during the trials. And I had traded a wristwatch that I got from, I don't know whether you remember, there was a show, used to be on TV, called Information Please. And there was a fellow named Clifton Fadiman, and a lady from England, and I forget what her name was for the moment. But anyway, when I had toured with them, a show that we took around to the army people, guys, so they could have a little entertainment, you know, this Information Please show went all over Germany, and I went with them and did the sound on it. And, what I was going to tell you was that, now I've forgotten what I really wanted to tell you.
The watch that you...
Oh, yeah, I traded it for a motorcycle, German motorcycle, a military motorcycle, and I rode that from Furth over to Nuremberg every day to the trials. And the way I kept it going was at the castle, there was a mechanic there, an old gentleman was a mechanic, and all I'd have to do is give him a few cigarettes, and he kept that bike running, you know, just like you'd want. And so that's what I had in mind to tell you about that.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, I don't know much more to tell you about.
Well, let's go back and talk a little bit about the trials themselves.
Yeah.
So you were going back and forth every day for
mm-hmm.
11 months to get the
right.
recordings done. And how did the proceedings go? Was it one person at a time or a group of people, or how did they...
They imported a Justice Jackson from the United States, and... it was a regular trial. These defendants had lawyers, and you may see one of those pictures might have the pictures of the lawyers out in front of them. And it was conducted just like any jury trial would be. And every day they would come and get in this dock, and the military police would be behind them so that they couldn't create any uprising or anything. And they had judges that sat opposite them, straight across on the other side of the courtroom. And our recording booth was right up above them, right to the back and up above them. And we could look down right on them, you know, and watch them and the proceedings in the trial. And Justice Jackson had lawyers with him, two military lawyers, a number of them, I'm sure. And that's how the trials proceeded. They tried each one separately. Mm-hmm. And the first, though, Justice Jackson made a statement about what they were going to try them for all the transgressions that they did and what they did to humanity. And that is where some of the most gruesome things came out in those trials. And they had movies of things you wouldn't believe happened to them, to these people.
Even though you don't want to get too gruesome, what is there anything that stands out as extreme?
I believe I told the folks there at the meeting, but there was one, the commandant for one of those, Dachau, I believe it was, but one of those, I'm not sure which, his wife loved to have skin from prisoners that they experimented on who had tattoos, and they would tan that skin and make lampshades. And her name was Elsa Kosh, I think, K-O-C-H or something like that. And that was one of the most gruesome things. And then there was one time when they were in some place, I don't know, it was some medical place where they had stacks of bodies, just one after another, in a tier, headless. You know. And you've seen the pictures from the Dachau and places like that. So you know what they were like. Those poor, poor people.
Did they show a lot of films then of things that were actually occurring?
Yeah, there's no way that these guys could get out of it. You know, they were part and parcel of it. They tried to say, well, we were only taking orders. But before the trials, that had been stated that would be no excuse, but they still did it. So they thought maybe they would lighten their sentences, I guess, or something. Mm-hmm. And that's where it went.
Did you find that any of the attorneys were especially skilled at getting information from people who might be reluctant to speak?
Well, strange as it seems, they most of them would admit some guilt, but try to minimize what they did, you know. But there was one or two, or maybe even three, that admitted they were guilty and they should be punished for what they did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, I don't know what to tell you more about that.
When they gave the sentences, how did the people respond to their death sentences?
They didn't seem to have too much emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Except Goring. He was taking down how many times that this lawyer had referred to him. I'd show you. They said in their cross-examination of Goring, he got the better of this American lawyer for 3 days. And finally, after the third day, the tables turned. And they said they left him shaking.
Mm-hmm.
When they finally got to the end of his cross-examination. But he was able to, in the end, he had his way. He took his own life.
Yeah. Were there a lot of witnesses, individual witnesses, or were there more films and those kinds of...
Yeah, there were witnesses who testified against them. Yeah, there were a number. I don't know how many. My time was, most of the time, I was either out on a remote recording or upstairs recording something. But I had my best friend in the Army. He was on the console most of the time. And if he wanted a break and I was free, I'd go down and take over for him. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't in there for the full trial, but I was in there quite often. You know. And so.
And were they recording, were the correspondents allowed in to take photographs and to do?
Yeah, we were.
And I imagine that was a
lot. They say that the courtroom was sold out until right after the end of the trial and before the sentencing. Then they said people didn't come until the sentencing. Then it was full again.
Mm-hmm.
So
there were
a lot of people there. Yeah.
11 months is a long time to spend every day.
Yeah. Well, I was kind of fortunate because I got out of there quite often to go make remote control or go with one of the correspondents to help him. I remember during the war one time when we were in Paris, I went on a flight with that's not true. That was in the United States. I went on before I even did this recording. I went on a flight where the paratroopers were training, and I got to see how they jumped out of this little airplane, the little two-motor airplane that was so used in World War II. And when they left, it was only myself and the pilot left in that airplane. And military person, I don't know what his grade was, but he would get them all riled up, and I'd say, is everybody going to jump? And they'd say, yeah, you know. And then they'd all get in line, and they'd hook up their lines, the static lines, so that when they jumped, the parachutes opened automatically. Well, I remember one fellow got up there and he sat down, and so this guy just took his boot and pushed him out. Yeah. But one of the fellows told me, he said, it wouldn't be so bad, but this afternoon we'll be back here doing it all over again. Yeah. So, as I told you, this show, the Information Police show, I got to tour Germany with them to do the sound for them, and that was interesting. We went to Patton's Third Army, you know, and we got almost put in the brig for being out of uniform. He was a stickler for uniforms. But we would go, we had B. Lilly, that was who was the lady. And we had a pianist, and we had a sergeant who, all he had to do was tune the piano. Every day we set up for, we'd move from one city to one little town to another, where the GIs were, you know. And he would set up his piano and tune it, and I'd set up the audio equipment, and that's all we'd have to do until the show was over. And then we would go wherever the GIs were, and that's where we would stay that evening and have our meals, you know. And the next day we'd be off to another location. And we were out, for maybe a month on that tour, something like that. That was an interesting thing, because I got to see some back German land, you know, other than in big cities. And that's why I say it's beautiful. We went through the Black Forest, where they had, the Germans had first gotten jet airplanes, and they were sitting back, and the Autobahn run right through there. And as you know, the Autobahn is a pretty good size highway. You could go 100 miles an hour if you care to, I guess. But anyway, they had cut out the forest underneath and had these planes sitting back there, so all they'd have to do was run them out on this Autobahn and take off. Mm-hmm. Well, they ran out of oil, and so there they were at the end of the war, those planes sitting there, and they couldn't get off the ground. And had they not bombed their oil supplies and got rid of the fuel for them, they would have done us more damage than you could imagine in them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and you said you were like the Glenn Miller Orchestra and that's
yeah, they were in Paris. That's Glenn Miller was lost over the English Channel. He was in a little what we'd call a Stinson airplane or something like that, a little two-passenger plane, you know, fellow was flying, and he was going ahead of the orchestra, because they were all GIs, and he was going over there to set things up, I guess, at the Olympic Theater there in Paris, and they never heard from him again. So someone else took over the orchestra, and it was all Glenn Miller's music there. And the GIs could go and see it. And in Paris there, you could go, we could go anywhere, a GI could go anywhere in that city, in the metro, which is the underground system for getting around, for 5 francs, which was about 3 or 4 cents, I think, in American money. So we got, and once I was assigned to that outfit, it was just like having a job, like you couldn't believe you had, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they would take, we had, at our studios, we were in the Scrib Hotel, which is a big hotel that used to be for the correspondents. And we were on the 3rd floor, and we had, as I say, 3 studios and a control room. And I normally was in the control room there, doing my work. And we had lines to England and fax machines, which in those days were a big old roller that rolled, and nothing like this we have now. And, well, it was just, as I say, just like having a job. And we would go, they had French chefs, and they would take our old GI hash and turn it into something that you couldn't believe, you know. We had the Army Hour broadcast from our studios, and it went out at midnight over there to get in here, I believe, at about 6 o'clock. And it was on the weekend, Sunday afternoon, I believe. And we did that out of our studios. Wherever they would pick up a remote control or remote recording, they'd bring it back to our studios, and it would be broadcast from there to the networks over in New York.
So these were not correspondents, but actually military people.
No, they were American correspondents from all of the news agencies and TV outlets in America. And I guess there was TV. I'm almost certain there was TV then. But
mm-hmm.
What, this would be in the 40s, early 40s. Yeah, there was TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had that, and we would get, some of the GIs would be able to broadcast to their folks at home through that. And also in Germany, then, myself and my best friend, who I told you was on the console there at the trial, we both got amateur radio calls, and we were probably some of the very first back on the air in Germany, and we had our ham station set up there, and those Germans must have thought me crazy, because if you've been to Germany, you'll notice that a lot of the apartments are 3 stories tall, and they have slate roofs, and we got up there and put our antenna up, you know, and I'm just sure that they thought we had lost our minds. But we did get to, we would handle a lot of traffic, guys who wanted to talk to their folks at home, and we could contact an American ham, and they had what we call phone patches, and they could actually talk to their people that way. And so that was, we liked to do that, you know, we did it wherever we could. It happened, we broadcast, and the ham band that we used, there are many ham bands, but the one we used then was what's called the 10-meter band, and it follows the sunspot cycles, and it has a high spot every 5.5 years, and goes down to a low spot, so that it has an 11-year cycle. And we just, in 1940, in the late 40s, well, early 40s there, it turns out it was with that peak, and that's how we were able to get into the United States almost daily.
Mm-hmm.
When we wanted to. Now, we did on commercial transmitters, but they used much lower frequencies, and that was available different times of the day, you know. But when we used the 10 meter band, it was most daylight hours. As soon as it got dark, that was the end of it. And we handled a lot of traffic for the GIs out there. We're happy, very happy to do that, because some of those guys were pretty lonely. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And after 2 years over there, Barry, we had a lady friend in New York City, and she looked for us every day, and she was as conscientious about it as we were, and most of those people that we got to talk to lived in New York, you know, and there were a lot of us fellows over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I've forgotten her call sign, but I still have my card up in my ham rig at home. Huh?
Do you use your ham radio even
today? Oh, yeah,
today?
Sure do.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Right now, we're in the down cycle of the 10 meters, but I have antennas for the lower bands, too, which I don't use very often. But I have a friend in Indianapolis who I got interested in ham radio before, well, right after I got out of the Army. And he and I converse every day when the band's open, mm-hmm. or most every day, unless he's busy doing something, you know. And it's just like talking to you and I. It's so good on a 10-meter band. And you don't have to have a big monster station. You could have just a little mm-hmm. small station.
Mm-hmm.
You know. It's great fun.
Is that okay?
At Nuremberg, the Red Cross set up a skating facility for the GIs. And this little, I call him little because he was short, and he was younger than I, and I used to get him so ticked off at me because his mother would send over eggplant. And I'd say, what in the world are you going to do with that? And he said, well, I'm going to eat it. What do you think I'm going to do with it, you know? and I told him, well, you know, and then he'd be talking to me about, or around the studio about something. And I'd say, well, if we get rid of these kids, we might get something done. And man, he'd just go crazy, you know. But he was my best friend, and I understand a few years ago he has expired with dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated to see that happen. But that's some of what I had fun doing. When we go to this in the evening, he and I, well, he sent a letter to his sister, and she sent us each a pair of figure skates, you know. And we'd go there and go skating in the evening, and that's recreation that we really liked. And in winter time, well, it was cold, and when it wasn't, they had ways to freeze that ice that they had there.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had hot coffee and donuts and all.
Did the Red Cross, what was the Red Cross's role?
To have nice things for the GI, mm-hmm. I would say.
And were they?
And they would, if you had, if you needed a loan, or if you had a problem with your family that you needed to go home, they'd try and get you a go see your commander and get you sent back, you know, one thing or another. They looked after the GIs pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
They were the only people to see. When I got back home, it was after all the war brides had gone home, because I didn't have, they had a point system. And because I never was in an active war situation, you know, closest I came was one day a buzz bomb dropped not too far from us in Paris. But that was just once, and it had nothing to do with me. But anyway,
sounds if you had a pretty lucky career there.
Oh, I can't believe how lucky I was, you know, even to get home. Anyway, went through Belgium, got back, and you could see the poor kids, what we dumped in the garbage, they would come and sift out to eat, you know. And when we first came over there to England, the little kids would line up on the sides there, you know, we'd throw them oranges. And man, they'd go crazy with them.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't chocolate, the French liked chocolate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the chocolate, old greasy chocolate that they had to put wax in to keep from melting, you know. But it was chocolate nonetheless. Yeah, the Army is something, or military is something that I wouldn't have wanted to miss, but I wouldn't have wanted to go back to it. Especially the way, I had a brother who saw the worst of it. He got caught at Anzio,
yeah.
And at the bar. He was in every invasion except the D-Day invasion, through Africa, Italy, Salerno. Come back without a scratch. So where would you like me to start on?
Well, let's talk about the end of your career and in the military.
In the military?
What rank you left with and then transition into the United States.
Okay, when I left Europe, I was a tech sergeant, and I had been over there 2 years, and in the military in the United States, 7 months, and I had left a wife who I'd been married to for approximately 2 years, and the last I saw of her, she was leaving Pennsylvania in a car with bald tires going back to Indianapolis, Indiana. And I worried about her for months until I finally heard from her. It wasn't email in those days, it was, I forget what they called it, but it was military mail, you know. And so when I finally got back to Indianapolis, I met her in that same car, but I'm not sure whether she had the same tires on it or not, but you know, they had trouble in those days of getting gasoline even. They had stamps and they could just get so much gas and tires and shoes and butter and whatever. Anyway, when we got home, she had rented one half of a duplex for us, which was quite nice. And that's how we started back to life. I could have gone to New York to the United Nations was starting. They were, I don't know whether the buildings were up then or not, but anyway, they were getting the United Nations together and they wanted our group to come there and do the same thing we did at the trial. But I didn't want any part of that. I wanted to get home, particularly New York. I didn't want to live in New York. So, that's what I did, went home, and I was very happy to get. I could have gone with a GI loan or GI payment to college, but never did do it because I was carefree and wanted to go fishing. And she and I went with another couple to Wisconsin from Indianapolis. And we spent about the summer there the first time, and then we would go back after that too. And then we had our first child, and he didn't live. He was born, stillborn, and then after the second child, she was so protective of that. So, as I've said, maybe we missed out it. My wife was very protective of our second little girl, and but she finally got to where she let Grandpa hold the little girl, Grandma too, and she grew up. My daughter grew up to be. I wouldn't have wanted a better daughter. She just never gave me a minute's trouble, nor her mother. And she is now in Texas. And she has a business that she does transcription for doctors from a hospital. She has her office in her home, and she does these transcriptions that they have to write in their case histories, you know. And she has blessed me with four sons, four grandsons, and one great-granddaughter, who is now 3 years old. I just had an email picture of her. She's going to have her birthday, I guess, next month. And I haven't seen her since I held her in my arms the first time I saw her at one of the wedding ceremonies of another brother. I mean, grandson. So, that's about all I can, at the moment, tell you about.
Thank you.